WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a civic media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. For now, a man named Luigi Mangione is jailed in Altoona, Pennsylvania on weapons and forgery charges. He's suspected of gunning down United Healthcare chief exec Brian Thompson in New York City last week. A worker at a McDonald's in Altoona recognized Mangione and called police. Deputy Chief Derek Swope.
He had asked the suspect if he had been in New York City recently, and that really invoked a physical reaction from the suspect. He became visibly nervous, kind of shaking at that question.
The 50-year reign of the al-Assad family in Syria is over. With Syrian rebels now in charge, Bashar al-Assad fled to asylum in Russia. The Syrian presidential palace was sacked after he left. American Airlines suspended its once-daily flight from Miami to Port-au-Prince, capital of Haiti. The move coming after at least 184 people were killed by rebels trying to bring down the government over the weekend. This is ABC News.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, WGBW.FM.
The Bucks beat Brooklyn. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Milwaukee Bucks picked up a win beating the Brooklyn Nets at the Barclays Center, 118-113. After the game, Doc Rivers agreed his team got off to a slow start.
You know, it's funny. It felt like we played awful offense. We were shooting 57% at halftime. But we turned the ball over and gave up offensive rebounds. And they had a 10-shot shot cushion on us. Now, the second half, we got to the foul line a lot, so it looked worse. But we only took 68 shots tonight, which is unheard of in a basketball game.
The Bucks host the Orlando Magic in an NBA Cup quarterfinal tomorrow night at Fiserv Forum. Baseball, Willie Adames agreeing to a 7-year contract with the San Francisco Giants over the weekend worth $182 million, the largest deal in that team's history. The 29-year-old shortstop played 4 years for the Brewers. NFL, Packers back at work in meetings and getting ready for a road trip to Seattle to play the Seahawks on Sunday Night Football. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Harvey K., Professor Emeritus of Democracy. We're talking about the Act 10 overturned by a Dane County judge.
I think it's important for everyone to know that this was the state that in 1959 first granted public employees the right to organize and bargain collectively. We have a lot to take back. You know, I used to say take back America, but I say take back Wisconsin.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. I want to talk about this Eli Crane, a Republican representative from Arizona, evidently is introducing a resolution to award the Congressional Gold Medal to this Daniel Penny guy. And you may remember this Daniel Penny guy intervened on a subway car loaded with commuters where somebody, you know, acting the fool, threatening people, claiming, you know, saying someone's going to die. This person intervened, protected a woman and a child. And look, laudable. Absolutely. You know, good Samaritan. I think, judging from the video, maybe a bit too far. But I'm going to always side on the side of someone being the good Samaritan. And unfortunate things can happen. The person that he was subduing died in the process. And I know there was a huge uproar, all kind of stuff. I don't think this guy should have been brought to trial for what happened. Just my view. But I do find it interesting that the politicization of this situation and the shooting of the CEO and how people have viewed it very differently. Because, look, if the goal was to protect innocent life, to protect that mother and a child from someone who is making threats, or, you know, as I believe, and I've had a lot of people who have agreed with me, that a system that is going to cost hundreds of people their lives today and probably another 100 or more tomorrow, that there should be some discussion. Look, I don't think the congressional gold medal should go to this person. A lot of good Samaritans do a lot of great things. You know, my wife, for instance, was involved in an accident. There was a good Samaritan who came and saved her life. I would love to put her up for the congressional gold medal. And I'm sure a lot of people would as well. But I look at this moment as an opportunity. Now, understand, I don't condone the killing of anyone. I don't condone violence at all. But I do understand it. And this is where my position has always been. I can't condemn it because I understand it. I understand the feeling. I don't condone it. And I think there's a strong position there. Because out of this CEO being killed, potentially thousands of lives might be saved by the fact that we've raised the awareness that this United Health Group denies almost a third of the claims that come in. And we know that people are going to die from that. We know those denials are going to delay care. We know that repeated denials will delay care even further. And a lot of people who are, especially seniors who are up in years, they don't have the time to be able to go through a whole lengthy, in a lot of cases, not even the ability to go through a lengthy appeals process. So by raising this awareness, we can fix a lot of this stuff. So for me, the benefit is not killing the CEO, and I think it's tragic. But out of this tragedy could come an opportunity for us to use this in a way to ensure that it doesn't happen again. And not by more bodyguards and not by more restrictive behavior and all of that, but by, solving the potential reason for it. And look, at this point, we're still guessing. And I may be proven wrong down the road. But the fact of the matter is, we do know these denials lead to deaths. We do know that we can and should do something about it, especially as we are privatizing Medicare. And I go back to this Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement and Modernization Act, the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003, that opened this door to privatization, that opened this window to these profitable companies taking over our Medicare and, well, using their bag of tricks of denial, delay, depose, to stop care from happening. And as I've said, you know, Medicare was that promise to seniors that you're going to get health care. When they passed this in 2003, they opened up a door. They gave a huge sales point to these private plans. You can negotiate for lower priced drugs. Medicare, we're not going to allow them. In fact, Medicare, you're going to pay full price. The poison pill was in the bill. And we're now going to be, in these next 4 years under Trump, in a situation where Medicare as we knew it is gone. It's now going to be privatized health insurance just like working people get. And it's going to come with all of the denials, all of the gridlock, all of the delays, all of the narrow networks. And it's going to cost lives. That simple. It is that simple in my view. So I look at this tragedy as an opportunity. I look at it as an opportunity to go, hey, why did this happen? You know, the interesting thing to me is the guy on the subway, I don't hear anybody asking why that person was deranged or whatever word, or out of his mind or whatever you want to hear. I don't hear anyone saying societally, how do we fix those problems? I think there's an opportunity here to fix a massive problem. And that is, in my view, stopping the privatization of Medicare and talking about what kind of health care, what kind of health insurance system we should have to get us the best care that we can get. We pay the most money. We should get the best care. Is this going to be that tragedy that raises that bar of awareness that gets us to go, hey, we can do better. We should do better. We must do better. Is that possible? I don't know, but I'm hoping. And as I've had a lot of people tell me, Rick, the answer is single payer. The answer is, you know, public health care. And I agree. This should be the battle cry in this moment. Instead, the privateers, the profiteers, the CEO class, they're just looking for revenge. Still not going to get you better health care. Want to hear your thoughts, though? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Angry emails. I'm actually enjoying those at this moment. So please, by all means, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Bob Nay is going to be here to share some thoughts.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, I got to get the thoughts on this congressional gold medal that we were talking about. Again, I still find it just incredible. Also, I want to get the thoughts on the shooting of the CEO of United Health Group, and the perfect person to ask, in my view, former member of Congress, someone who might have some thoughts on the congressional gold medal. And also, you know, like I said earlier, you know, the privatization of Medicare, kind of a big deal. That's why I asked my good friend Bob Nay to come share some thoughts. He's a former congressional member from Ohio, also one of my top political analysts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So I've got to get your thoughts on this Representative Eli Crane from Arizona saying that he wants to award this Daniel Penny, who went to the rescue of a woman and a child, restrained a guy who was having an episode. The guy ended up dying. They now want to give him the Congressional Gold Medal. I want to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I was at one of the ceremonies for the Congressional Gold Medal, which was Mother Teresa. And I was personally at that presentation. In fact, I carried the floor mechanics, the proceedings to let the rotunda be used for the ceremony. And I'm recalling other people that have received it. And some celebrities, obviously, the Dalai Lama also. I think didn't Boehner get it for the Pope? I forget. But anyway, it's a high honor. And to give it, and I'm not going to debate, you know, what the guy did on the bus and the other, you know, person was terrorizing passengers or whatever. But for the congressman to suggest that goes to the level of a congressional gold medal, I think, is just absolutely absurd. Yeah. It's ridiculous for him to even bring that up. This is one individual thing. Look, we have heroes every day that, you know, push a child aside and so they're not hit by a car.
Look, the woman who came to my wife's aid on the road when she had her motorcycle accident. Was there at her side within 30, 45 seconds, saved her life on the scene. That woman's a hero. Where's her congressional gold medal?
Right. So, this congressman's just a publicity seeker.
But, you know, the juxtaposition for me, and I talked about it a moment ago with, you know, the killing of this CEO, This idea that, you know, you're saving someone's life and you're killing someone to do it. And I guarantee when this shooter is caught, they'll say, look, you know, 100 people, probably more, die every day because of the denials and the policies of United Health Group and other insurers. That I'm sure the argument's going to be, you know, that this was defending others. And I'm curious why we don't look at them the same.
Well, I think it's just not a solution, because get a new CEO, they're going to have a higher pay, danger pay. They're going to have more security, you know, maybe hire a whole slew of security people for them. So taking them out's not going to solve it. Changing the system will solve it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, Bob, the hope is that this raises awareness. It's tragic. It's horrible. I don't condone it. Let me be very clear about that. But the hope is that out of this, it raises awareness that United Health Group, about a third of the claims that people put forward get denied. The hope is that raises our awareness that corporations that these insurance companies are doing this, especially as, you know, I just talked about this recently, about the fact that as we continue to privatize Medicare and put it into the hands of insurers like United Health, who is one of the largest insurers of Medicare recipients, that this is the future for those Medicare, for people like you, Bob.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've had experiences through the system. You know, I used to make phone calls for constituents all the time to insurance companies, life, health, you know, healthcare. I used to do that all the time. Sure. Calls for veterans that were having trouble through the VA system. And now I do it for myself because I've hit a few snags here and there in the system. And of course, for other people, I think it'd be super difficult how they would navigate through the system. I mean, I know enough about it. I know enough about which buttons to push, you know, and I've done that, but it's difficult. And for other people, I think it's, you know, super difficult. I still get phone calls, people asking me, what do I do? This happened to me, my health care, and they'll call me and I'll say, well, do this, call here, call your congressperson, you know, and I give them advice what to do. But it's a complicated system. I mean,
it's too complicated, and it shouldn't be. Medicare was supposed to be, you get to be 65, you get to that age, you get health care. It's a right. It's not an opportunity to get care. It's a right. And I go back to 2003 when the Medicare Prescription Drug and Improvement and Modernization Act was passed and opened up this privatization window, to which the United Health Groups and others, I think, are taking way too much advantage of, and turning Medicare, which again, like I said, was supposed to be a right, into a, well, the kind of crappy insurance most Americans have.
And some of it, you know, was decent in the bill, and some of it ended up not to be. The fact that only these plans can negotiate with prescription with Big Pharma, and Medicare itself couldn't, which Medicare itself would be, I think, more powerful to negotiate.
Yeah,
you know, than
absolutely
the individual plans. And the plans were created to hold prices down, more efficiency. You didn't have to go through the labyrinth of Medicare. You had the plans to do it for you. I mean, these were all the theories at the time. So maybe it's time to revisit
the theories. No, look, and look, you voted for this, right?
Yes.
You know, this is what were you sold? Because, you know, for me as an outsider, as a working class person, I know privatization has been bad in virtually everything that we did for ourselves, whether it's parking authorities, highways, you know, whatever. Medicare now, it's been, when there's a profit motive in there, our services get worse, our ability to access them get harder, and the profit motive becomes more important. So for me, this is predictable. But I'm curious, you know, how are you sold this, as this was the first major overhaul of Medicare, the biggest overhaul, that how are you sold that this was going to be good, anything than what it's been?
Well, in a couple of ways, HHS actually came into the district I represented and did a whole forum on this, you know, Health and Human Services did themselves. Advocacy groups, of course, were supporting this. And so it sounded like a good deal in the sense of being able to have these plans, negotiate better prescription prices. Number two, having the plans be able to take you through the labyrinth, which is, you know, when I signed up for this, for Medicare, I didn't go pure Medicare, as I call it. I signed up through one of the plans, mine being Aetna, because, you know, they can guide me with the doctor choices and the service choices. It's sort of like was a backstop where I don't make the mistake. They have to tell me what is approved or not approved. And that was the theory of it back in 2003. Now, time has shown they don't save money through the system. I think time's shown that.
No, in fact, it's cost more to move to these Advantage plans because of the profit motive that's in it, because their profit motives are in the 15% range, whereas Medicare itself was less than 3%. So there's a lot of healthcare dollars not being spent on healthcare. And look, we've opened this door. It's not closing. And I look at the fact that this CEO was tragically, you know, killed. I mean, nobody wants this. But to take the moment to look at it and go, is this a system that we want to continue as we're continuing to privatize Medicare? As we know, a company like this has, you know, a third of denial rates. Shouldn't this be one of those awakening moments that we go back and revisit this bill that was passed in 2003?
Well, I mean, in the midst of a tragedy, it brings certain things out. I had an argument with a friend today. She was saying that this was like the Robin Hood deal. And I'm like, no, this guy's a vigilante. He shouldn't have shot this guy, no matter what the reason. But in the midst of this, if he did, in fact, do this because of denials, then it will raise the issue. There's no question a bad thing will still spotlight. That happens a lot. There was a lawyer one time that was the guy, due to a divorce case, was trying to shoot him, you know, behind a tree, and it led to where there was clarification in divorce law. You know, so sometimes out of some of the bad things, some ideas float to the surface.
Yeah, no, as I've been saying in the last several weeks, you know, out of the suffering, out of the tragedy, out of the savagery will come solutions. And I'm hoping out of this, because as I've said, I don't condone the shooting, but I'm also not going to condemn it, because sadly, we have a system that's set up that, you know, especially as we move to privatize more of this, how many old people who are going to get to Medicare age, how many people are going to be denied? And unfortunately, they don't have the time and sometimes the ability to navigate the system that you have. How many people are going to lose their lives because of this? And that's kind of where my position is. I do got to get some of your other thoughts. Obviously, the new year is going to bring a new president, a new 100 days. There's talk of an ambitious 100-day agenda. What are you looking at?
Well, there's going to be an agenda out of the White House. The Senate, of course, has a cushion, but the House really doesn't have much of a cushion at all. The votes are close. Right now it's at 220, I think it is, with the Gates seat. They've all been decided except the Gates seat is, you know, going to be a special election. And if you look at the margins that Johnson has, it's very, very close. Now, if in fact anybody acts up to go after the speaker themselves from the Republican side, they're going to be in severe, severe trouble. Severe. The House would be paralyzed. So the Trump agenda probably will put the fear in a lot of the Republicans to not act up against Johnson. I mean, Trump realizes if Johnson gets in trouble, Trump's in big time trouble.
Yeah. So the whole agenda goes down. And as I understand that, the number one goal is obviously going to extend Trump's tax cuts. They're going to cost, you know, what, $4.6 trillion. That's going to, you know, expand that. Do you see much beyond that?
No, because nobody, the sin of both parties and the presidents, Trump, Biden, Obama, Bush in his last years, nobody cares about the deficit. Nobody. I mean, they really don't.
No.
And so they're not going, at least if, I mean, if whether you care about defense spending or you care about, you know, helping people and programs, whatever your concern is, eventually they have to start doing budgets again to look at every single line item and talk these things through like it used to happen. And they don't do it. Now, I don't see that on the agenda. I don't see that on agenda whatsoever. There'll be tax cuts. There won't be the handling of, you know, of the budget process. I don't believe there will be. They'll punt this down the road. Immigration will be a, you know, a big part of this. Probably energy issues. Try to roll back the EV, electrical vehicle issues. That'll be out there. You know, so I think those are some of the things that they're going to see in the first 100 days. Again, the battle's going to be in the House.
Sure. No, I'm looking. It's a, as someone pointed out to me, recently, people change. People change all the time. I think he said like 30 some people died in the last couple of years in Congress. So the potential of just that kind of changeover, who knows what happens to Trump's agenda. But I do know he's going to try a lot with executive order. There's talk of pardoning a lot of the January 6th criminals. There's some of that. There's also talk of going after military officers, because evidently there's a list by the American Accountability Foundation of 20 generals and senior admirals that evidently they claim are too woke. And that there's talk that they're going to go after those officers.
I had not heard that.
See, this is the kind of stuff that's interesting to me, in that I fear that we have a situation where the administration starts going after people. Do you expect that, or do you think that's just a lot of bluster and a lot of good rage material?
I think there'll be some of it. But there's a couple of things I don't think are going to happen. It's not going to be at all levels of the government, number one. Number two, 2025 changing of the law, and he can't do it through executive order to change civil service law. I don't think it's going to happen to the extent of what the Heritage Foundation wanted to happen. The DOGE is going to be fascinating, because Vivek Ramaswamy and Elon Musk will come up with all these ideas. It'll put a lot of pressure, and then there'll be all kinds of internal private debate. Look, appropriators under Republican control are going to want to do something, Rick. They're going to want to spend money for areas they oversee. I've seen it. I've seen it over and over and over. They're going to want to do that. And, of course, they'll quote on one end, well, here's what the DOGE report says, and on the other end, here's what we're going to do. Ramaswamy and Musk are going to have they're going to find out they're going to have a hard time with the system, put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, because people got to get it reelected. You know, look, I do think there's going to be a lot of pain and suffering. I think they are going to make a lot of cuts, especially to the people who are most vulnerable. I think there will be a massive redistribution of wealth that will continue to people like Musk and others, but I'm not sure that that Musk and Vivek are going to be very thrilled. And it's going to be interesting to see how far he can go and how long Trump tolerates him. That for me is going to be the interesting part.
Well, exactly. Also, they scheduled the first meeting, and the Senate had recessed and had left at 3:00. They had a meeting. The Senate was out of town, most of them. So they're going to have to learn how the system works, first of all, in the House and Senate.
Well, evidently,
you don't schedule meetings after they're gone.
Yeah, evidently, the Senate's going to work in a very ambitious term, according to, I guess, John Thune. So they're going to work Fridays now.
Well, Thune has to. I mean, he's the new guy in town after 18 years of McConnell in key positions. Wasn't always the leader, but in key positions. And Thune's the new guy. Yeah. I mean, I served with John, and so he'll be the new guy on the block, and he's got to produce some things. It'll be easier probably for him to produce than for Johnson in the House.
Well, we'll see what happens. But, Bob, as always, I appreciate the time. Lastly, you regret voting for that Medicare bill?
Well, parts of it were okay.
Given the fact that you're having a little problem yourself, you regret it yet?
But like this, regretting the Iraq vote, that's one I can say for sure I did because we were lied to. And I wish they would have done something with the people that lied to us. But, it's a hard question to answer because, you know, we thought it would help at the time. And so now it needs retooled. So if I was still in office, I would say, you know, intentions were the best, but now it's failing and we've got to do something else with it.
Yeah. What's that? The road to hell is paved with good intentions. I see this as that. But Bob, as always, I appreciate the time, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our good friend Bob Nay, former Ohio Congressman, political analyst. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Back after this.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Clouds stick around tonight, a little breezy, lows in the upper 20s. And mostly cloudy for tomorrow, a high into the low 30s. Some snow showers late tomorrow night into Wednesday, falling temps through the 20s and becoming breezy. It's 42 right now.
The holidays are here, and it's nearly time to pick a present from our grown-up gift list with our Civic Media statewide text-to-win contest. Listen while you work for the keywords to text for your chance to win $100 cash, an overnight vacation at Chula Vista Resort, and be entered to win one of our grand prizes, a robot vacuum, new luggage, humidifier, espresso machine, and more on our grown-up gift list at civicmedia.us. Just download the Civic Media app and listen weekdays at 7, 11, 1, and 4 for your chance to win in our statewide contest.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some interesting news. On December 8th, Reuters reported that the Taiwanese defense minister said that China had nearly doubled the number of warships that are operating around the island. And look, you know, they got their war games. They do all that stuff. Show of muscularity. And the Chinese are militarily showing a little muscle. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, especially as Trump is talking about massive tariffs and being more aggressive. Because as I understand, you know, I guess it's like 10 to 20% for everybody else, but upwards of 60% of things coming out of China. And is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Where is it going to take us? Well, that's why I've asked my China expert to come share some thoughts. That's why I've asked Emily de la Bruyere to come talk with us. She's the co-founder of Horizon Advisory. You can check out their website, horizonadvisory.org. Emily, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So what do you make of this? I mean, we've seen these stories before that China's, you know, flexing their muscles a little bit around Taiwan. I think not just to intimidate them, but also kind of us as well. What do you make out of that? And what do you make out of, especially as you know, we look towards the Trump administration, do we expect more of this?
Yeah, it's all of those things. It's a message to Taiwan. It's a message to the U.S. It's also a message to the rest of the world, right? China, a big thing that we've seen over the past few years, and that's only going to accelerate, is China is trying to make it clear to the global system that it's China's time now. And they're not going to back down, and they're going to build out a global network of partners, and they're going to advance a different global order. All of that messaging is very much there with the Taiwan movements. There's also part of this that's a message to the Chinese domestic population. Whenever China feels threatened domestically or on the global stage and is worried about popular sentiment, they tend to be much more aggressive toward Taiwan, because that way you kind of rally the domestic internal troops and turn their attention elsewhere. So that's like a big thing that's going on with all of this. And of course, there are stories about, you know, there might be economic challenges to China, but in particular, the big story right now is that there's much, much more confrontational U.S. language on China from what the incoming Trump administration has said. And that's definitely something that the Chinese government is probably working to twist or avert attention from domestically.
Right. But, you know, the question that I have is because, you know, I'm looking at what Biden did. Biden kept most of Trump's tariffs, you know, and I don't see much of a, I don't see Trump actually doing much more. I see him saying a lot, as he did in his first term. I see a lot of bluster. I see a lot of posturing, but, you know, I don't know that I see him doing the, I don't see him putting 60% tariffs on things, maybe a couple of symbolic things, but I don't see the kind of muscular push that's being portrayed, or am I wrong?
I mean, that's the big question of the moment. And obviously it's impossible really to know. I think, one big signal beyond the talk and the tweets or whatever they're called now, is who Trump's picked for his cabinet so far. And it is like probably worth noting that the picks the last Trump administration was very much torn in two on the China question. Half the administration was pretty remarkably China friendly, half was major China hawks. The picks so far are much more in the China hawk category, or at least have made statements in the lead up to being selected and immediately post-selection that are very hawkish on China. And I think that signals that there actually is a resolve and that there's more consistency in the current approach to the administration on China than there was in the previous one.
So
look,
I'm not against the idea of taking on China and regaining some of our manufacturing prowess and leveling the playing field and doing a lot of those things. But I, you know, again, I saw the first time around a lot of bluster, a lot of we're going to make a deal, and well, didn't really work out.
Well, the other thing is like the U.S. has to do more than just tariffs.
Clearly.
Even if Trump were to go in and put 60% tariffs on China, China's already building up facilities and partnerships with other countries all around the world to make sure that it can get around those tariffs. And China's already built facilities in the U.S. that obviously are in tariff because they're in the U.S. There's a much like there has to be an actual paradigm shift, for lack of a better word, in China's place in the international system and the international trade system that goes beyond tariffs to make a real difference.
So walk me through some of that, because, you know, I've got some listeners who say, well, you know, you've never been to China. You don't know how good it is. And I haven't. There are some people who tell me China's wonderful. It's utopia, Emily.
I mean, if your utopia is an environment where everything you do is monitored and determined by the government, if your utopia is an environment where there's an ongoing domestic genocide against not just one, but multiple ethnic minorities, and one where the private sector is under the thumb of the government, they decide who wins and who loses, they lock up executives because those executives say the wrong thing about them. And also if your utopia is the country that is actively trying to take down the United States, then that's your utopia. It happens not to be mine.
No, that's not mine either. But I've had some listeners who have really come after me on this question. And I'm like, look, at the end of the day, they're cheating in every way, shape, or form. And we allow them to do it because we've got interests, corporate interests all over the place that make sure that they line their pockets over the interests of all of the working people of this country. I want somebody who's going to take on China. And if Trump's that guy, I will applaud him for doing it. You know, I may not like a lot of other policies, but I think this is an issue that I think he can do well if he has an actual policy. So what would you, if you were an advisor, if he brought you on in the cabinet, what do you suggest?
I mean, I would say day one, you revoke China's permanent normal trade relations status.
Should have done that already.
Right, exactly. And that's the kind of thing that like actually changes their place in the international architecture. And then I also think make that number one. Number two is the U.S. has to use its international partnerships in a way that's actually beneficial to American interests vis-a-vis China, not just like brings those down to the lowest common denominator. Right now, we as a country have made like too many concessions to our allies about how they treat China. And that makes our allies or any trade partners loopholes. China uses them to circumvent our trade measures, for instance, or our investment restrictions. So basically, to U.S. allies, you get to choose between the U.S. market, and if you want the U.S. market, you have standards vis-a-vis China that are as high as ours, or you go off, you do your own thing, maybe you get the Chinese market if they don't use their domestic champions to kick them out first, to kick you out first. And the third thing would be policy vis-a-vis U.S. companies. I think there should be a much clearer, it should be mutually exclusive for U.S. companies, whether you're doing business with and helping China or you're doing business with and helping the United States. And that includes where you store your data. It also includes where you invest and where you produce your goods.
I would like to see some of that, absolutely. And what do you think the chances are that that actually happens, given the fact that so many of us have been sold? And I think, look, there were people who were supportive of Kamala Harris saying, no, tariffs are bad. It's, you know, it's all this, that a lot of the things that you talked about that they were against. How would that, I guess, affect the average working person in this country? And do you think this would spark that trade war everyone's concerned about?
I mean, there's no doubt about it. If all of this were to happen, it would cause immediate pain for every American who cares about the price tag on anything. And obviously, like, that's what all the headlines are right now too. Here's what tariffs would do for your pocketbook. And I'm watching my language, is already expensive. Like, none of us wants it to be more expensive. That said, the current system of China cheating to manipulate international prices and to get us addicted to cheap Chinese goods, that's a bad system.
Oh, it's terrible.
And that keeps us from being able to make anything and to compete and do the things that give us Americans jobs such that we can afford things that aren't cheap Chinese goods. And like, we're addicted to the crack of Chinese products.
Oh,
it's
no,
not going to be an easy thing to turn that off, but we have to if we're going to have an economic future.
No, and I look at, you know, sites like Temu and Shein and these other ones and all this direct shipment from China. Someone's got to close that loophole as well, because then, you know, nothing else matters if you don't close off that crack dealer angle right there.
Yeah, exactly. And like, it's going to hurt. All of it is going to hurt. But it hurts more to have the hollowed out industry that we have right now.
So I come back to, you know, how much of this can Trump do on day one as dictator? How much of this is going to need congressional approval? And how popular will that be, given the fact that we've got a very closely divided House? You know, Republicans control the Senate, but they don't have a filibuster-proof majority. And I don't know that I see Democrats filibustering much on this front, but I want to hear your thoughts.
I mean, China has been a bipartisan issue. The Biden administration continued policies from the Trump administration. There's been more bipartisan cooperation on this issue than probably any others over the past however many, 8 years. I think it might actually not be a question of party consensus. And there are actually divides within the parties that might influence it more. So you might see allegiances is the wrong word, but partnerships between Democrats and Republicans trying to advance policy on China or support administration policy on China, but breakaways from groups within their own parties who disagree.
Strange bedfellows, in other words.
Exactly.
And look, like, you know, this for me is another one. If you're in the working class, this is one of those issues. I think that is a which side are you on kind of scenario. And I don't care about Democrat, Republican, Independent. This could be one of those defining moments.
Exactly. And there are wings of both parties that are on very different sides of this. Like, the Republican tradition is the free market, which with China is not really a free market, but, keep all doors open. And it's only recently that there's been a shift of that approach towards the hawkish hardline on China one, and using economic tools for that. And then the Democrats have basically the same split within their party too.
Yeah, I guess the question then becomes, you know, we as voters, because as you pointed out a moment ago, you know, the last election really was about the price of eggs instead of a woman's eggs, or, you know, the price of gas instead of, you know, a whole bunch of other things. Do you think as a country we have the stamina, the will, the ability to last out what will be, as you admit, a very painful transition? Because it's going to be. It was easy to get into this. It was really easy to get addicted to cheap Chinese garbage. The rehab, that's going to be tough.
It's going to be really tough. And I don't know, especially because we're working against an adversary that obviously is designed to be able to hold on in the long term. I think a big part of it depends on the U.S. private sector. And if they, you know, decide, okay, like we're waking up reading tea leaves or smelling the coffee, depending on what caffeine of choice, and getting ahead of the curve here. Because if the U.S. private sector says, okay, that's it, we're investing domestically and we're matching the limitations that are being placed with a bump in supply, that changes the equation. But if that's not true and everyone keeps going business as usual, but prices go up, that's, we're not going to make it.
No. I have very little hope in policymakers to have the courage to do what's necessary out of fearing that they're going to get slaughtered at the ballot box when that pain reaches home, much like we saw in this last election. Look, I thought Biden was doing the right thing, moving the country on the right track on a lot of issues, moving away from neoliberalism, maybe not as fast as I would want, but still moving away, investing in new technologies, reshoring some manufacturing. I thought all good policies in the right direction, just did a crummy job of highlighting it. But all that stuff is now over, and I think most of it will be, overturned and reversed, which will set us, I think, back in different ways. But on this China issue, this is something I think that could unite, but I don't think we're going to take pain for long.
There's so many elements of the story too. Like, there's a different equation too. If the population can wake up and say, actually, we need to fight China. Like, we're in a war, we need to accept this and fight the war, but I don't think we're ready for that as a country, and I don't think, right, this is a negative take. Maybe we are, but there's so much self-loathing about the country, and there's a tiredness, and I think that makes it a lot harder to get into that mentality and have the push from the people as opposed to the push from a different direction.
So let me ask you this. This is, you've taken kind of a view that I agree with. I believe that this country only really unites during times of crisis, yeah. When there's pain and suffering. And look, I have been saying about the Trump administration that I think they're going to do horrible things. I think bad things are going to happen to people, and that, you know, the solutions will come out of the savagery and the suffering that this administration is going to cause. And that could be a unifying thing. But this could also be a unifying, right, left, center. For the most part, most people, I think, are somewhere in the, we've got to take on the communist Chinese, who, from dominating manufacturing, dominating the global economy, and creating their own, you know, basket of currencies or whatever. There's a lot there to dig into. Or do you think so?
Absolutely. And I also think that if you take most of the major problems in our country and the world that people are worried about, if you solve the China problem, you solve that problem too. If you care about jobs and U.S. manufacturing, you solve China, you solve that, obviously. If you care about climate, you solve China, you solve that. Like, these things all work together. If you care about instability and proxy wars around the world, you solve China, you solve that too. There are so many things, but that's not how the issues are framed. And if we can reframe them, and if that can actually enter the popular sentiment in a way that maybe people are primed for, as you say, I think a lot of people are from all sides are realizing what a threat China is. But I think it takes taking all the, you know, different heads of the Hydra, bringing them together and saying, no, but this is all about China.
Yeah. Now, don't we have to at some point stop the Chinese from, you know, addicting our children to video crack? I mean, and I'm going to bring up the TikTok ban, of which, you know, I've had a lot of people, no, you can't do that. And look, I'm not a big fan of banning things, but I think foreign governments having, you know, direct access into our children's bedrooms, because I think a lot of parents have fallen down on this front. I don't know this, or into any of our bedrooms, because quite frankly, I don't know that we've handled social media well. As a country, as a society, but certainly not having Chinese propaganda at our fingertips every minute of the day. Do you see anything on that front?
I mean, it has to happen, right? It's shaping the minds of the youth. It's also shaping the American political ecosystem and the American commercial ecosystem. That's a lot of power to be giving China. And I mean, it's a foreign adversary. Like, we can take measures on TikTok and not be breaking our system because it's a foreign adversary. and CFIUS exists, there's a precedent for this. The problem is, A, it's been so many years and so little progress on actually banning TikTok. This is one of the things that will cause a direct domestic backlash to, because, you know, as you said, it's the ultimate video crack and everyone's addicted to it. And third, even if we manage to ban TikTok, I bet you any amount of money, there will be a new version of TikTok run by a new Chinese company that's really the same Chinese company and has the same ties to the Chinese government, and that'll come in tomorrow. And that's why there has to be something bigger and more systemic than just the whack-a-mole, hit them with tariffs, grab this company, fight this front out of 100.
No, I mean, there's so much, and because we give so many foreign countries access to our market and access to our media that, you know, you don't know what's coming. And look, you know, they're more than happy to fund Americans to move their propaganda, and, you know, the almighty dollar does a lot. I'm not sure where we go from here. But let me ask you a last line of questioning, because clearly this is going to be an issue. Clearly this is going to be something that we're going to be paying attention to over the next several years. What are you paying attention to specifically as the transition happens? Trump is going to get a honeymoon that he didn't get, I think, the first time around. World leaders are treating him nicely. There's a new charm offensive. What are you paying attention to? What are you looking for as Trump takes office?
That's
a huge question. I know.
It's a huge question. I think, so obviously I'm looking in through the China lens. And that's the number one thing I'm looking at. I think the order in which things happen is really important policy-wise. Do we see day one, the first 100 days, they're all about the border, or are they about China? And obviously there's some overlap between those things, but that's going to be a prioritization that really matters, because that's where, whatever that first thing is, that's somewhere where costs are going to be absorbed, and the second and the tertiary ones, less so. So that's one. And I think in terms of messaging to other international players, if there is a honeymoon, what is the message? Is it you better catch up on China, or is it just let's be buds, or is it just I'm going to hit you with 25% tariffs and there's nothing you can do about it?
Yeah, my fear is that he goes that route and the world organizes around us with China on a certain level and undermines everything that we try to do. But we'll see how this plays out. Emily, as always, I appreciate you taking some time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Our good friend Emily de la Bruyere. I want to hear your thoughts, co-founder of the Horizon Advisory. Check out the work that they do, horizonadvisory.org. I want to hear your thoughts. Is China the issue? Is this that which side you're on issue? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I want to hear your thoughts. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1953. That was the day that Ralph Cordiner, president of General Electric, issued his Cordiner Doctrine. It was the height of McCarthyism and the second Red Scare. The House Un-American Activities Committee persisted in its witch hunting of trade unionists, labor militants, and alleged communists. It targeted many of the unions purged from the CIO in 1949. The United Electrical Workers was one of those unions. The UE had organized the electrical manufacturing industry, including General Electric. Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy and HUAC each began investigating UE Local 301 at the General Electric plant in Schenectady, New York. GE didn't like the militancy of the UE or the bad publicity McCarthy generated about the company harboring subversives. So President Cordiner issued a memo which stated that any employee called before a Senate or legislative committee hearing who invoked the Fifth Amendment in response to inquiries regarding alleged communist ties shall be terminated. When McCarthy came to Albany, New York to hold hearings on alleged subversive activities 3 months later, hundreds of UE members packed the room, booing and jeering the senator and cheering the defendants. One African-American worker demanded, "Why don't you investigate subversion by GE of the Jim Crow system, of the profits taken from the sweat of my people?" McCarthy abruptly ended the hearings, but 28 UE members would be fired at General Electric. Other electrical manufacturers like Westinghouse soon followed suit.
It was a devastating blow to the union and to the fired members who had helped build the UE from the ground up. But the union persevered and remains a powerful representative force for workers in the industry today.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I think Emily's right on a lot of fronts here. You know, China is going to be a big player, and the Trump administration is going to have an opportunity. Look, I'll be quite frank with you. I've been saying for a long time, you got to take on China. You've got to reshore manufacturing. You've got to hold them accountable. Repealing permanent normal trade relations should be a part of that. I thought it was a mistake during the Clinton years to grant it, especially without a temporary status, a sunset to begin with, to ensure that they did play by rules that we set. They haven't. So at some point, the international community, not just us, but the rest of the globe is going to have to figure out, hey, how do we pull them into what is international norms? Instead of being the mercantilist country that they have become, the weight to the bottom. Understand, I'm not anti-Chinese worker. I'm anti-Chinese communist government. I'm against what they're doing. And what they're doing is, quite frankly, if you were going to let me, it is something that I would do myself. I'm going to try and dominate every corner of every economy, of every industry. I'm going to try and be the one that does all of the manufacturing. I want to be the global manufacturer. I want you to come to me for all of your needs, because now I'm indispensable. Now I can make a bunch of profit. Once we corner a market, we own that market. And we can do anything you want. So this idea that, especially that my Republican friends are, well, it's about competition. No, the competition train has left the station a long time ago. Because we were sold, and you may remember, because I know I were due, we were sold on the idea that it was going to be about competition. You'd be able to go to the store and you could see an American-made product. You could see a Chinese-made product. You could see a European-made product. And you, as consumers, could choose which was best for you. If you're like me, you're willing to spend an extra buck or two on something that's made in the U.S. by maybe my neighbors, you'd have that choice. You know, that's one of the words Republicans love to throw out, choice. When reality is, you don't have the choice that you think. Because you go to the store, I don't see that U.S.-made product anymore. It's been crushed by Chinese anti-competitive measures. What we do, we allowed U.S. companies to go over there to exploit cheap labor. What did they do? They retro-engineered and stole the product and sold it back to us for their profit. So not only did we lose jobs, you lost the company that used to have those jobs and the intellectual property that came with it. Quite remarkable. Now, look, I'm an anti-Trump guy. I'll be honest with you. I think he's going to do very bad, very horrible things. I think he is going to be one of the largest disgraces in the history of our country. But this is an issue that, if he does right, I will give him credit for. Now, do I think that's going to happen? No, I don't. I really don't. I think there's going to be a lot of bluster. I think there's going to be a lot of positioning. But I also believe that as a country, we're not ready for the pain and the struggle that would come out of the kind of trade war that this is going to spark. I truly believe we're not that country. And they know that too. So there's going to be a lot of lipstick put on this pig. There's going to be a lot of posturing, like I said, but I don't know about the substance. We'll see. We'll see how it plays out. I want to hear your thoughts, though. What do you think? Do you think the Trump administration is going to do anything different than Biden has done? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. As always, you can find that at thericksmithshow.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And, you know, hey, thanks for being here, man. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Always great having you here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com.
This is 97.9 WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a civic media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. Luigi Mangione is in custody in Altoona, Pennsylvania. He's suspected of being the gunman who shot and killed UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson in New York City last week. Lieutenant Colonel George Bivens of the Pennsylvania State Police says he was busted inside a McDonald's.
Customer recognized, notified an employee, and wanted someone to check it out further.
Altoona officer Tyler Fry was one of the police who confronted Mangione and asked him to pull down his mask.
My partner and I recognized him immediately, just from what we saw in the media with photos, videos.
Late word, New York prosecutors have filed a murder charge against Mangione. A jury in New York City acquitted Marine veteran Daniel Penny in the chokehold killing of Subway performer Jordan Neely. Neely's family plans to sue Penny. About 87,000 people were being evacuated in the central Philippines after a brief but major eruption of the Mount Canlaon volcano. This is ABC News.